Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. As Senator Chuck Grassley tries to strong-arm Dr. Ford, Congress can't finalize their own misconduct deal. Seven women who have come forward about experiencing sexual harassment while they worked in Congress made a public plea today for lawmakers to finalize a deal to strengthen Capitol Hill's misconduct policing system. In a letter to congressional leaders, a copy of which was shared with Politico, the women described themselves as dismayed and disheartened by Congress's failure to act and take care of its own by agreeing on final legislation modernizing the Hill's workplace harassment rules. The women write, "The work was tainted by harassment and abuse nurtured by a culture of secrecy and an unforgiving, flawed system that protects those in power rather than those who need protection most." Wow. A culture of secrecy and an unforgiving, flawed system that protects those in power. Sounds exactly like what Grassley, McConnell, and Graham are doing to Dr. Ford to protect Kavanaugh. U.S. blacklists Chinese agency for buying Russian military equipment. Today, the United States imposed sanctions on a Chinese military agency and its director for buying defense equipment from Russia in breach of a sweeping U.S. sanctions bill enacted in 2017. The U.S. State Department said it would immediately impose sanctions on China's Equipment Development Department, which oversees defense technology, and its director, Li Shangfu, for engineering or engaging in significant transactions with Rosatom Export, Russia's main arms exporter. The measures come as Donald Trump's administration pursues a variety of strategies to clamp down on China and faces growing pressure to respond strongly to U.S. intelligence agencies' reports that Russia is continuing to meddle in U.S. politics. The sanctions block the Chinese agency from applying for export licenses and from participating in foreign exchange transactions under U.S. jurisdiction. Problems continue to grow for Ron DeSantis in Florida. A Republican activist who donated more than $20,000 to Ron DeSantis' gubernatorial campaign and lined up a speech for him at President Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club called President Obama a effing Muslim N-word on Twitter recently, in addition to other inflammatory remarks. Stephen Alembic told Politico he wrote the Obama tweet in anger, that he's absolutely not a racist, and that he understood that DeSantis' campaign for governor would need to distance himself from the comments, which the campaign promptly did. The controversy comes after DeSantis sent his campaign into a tailspin the day after the August 28th primary by using the phrase "monkey this up" in describing how the economy could falter under the plans of his opponent, Andrew Gillum, the Florida Democratic Party's first African-American nominee for governor. Claire McCaskill to vote no on Kavanaugh confirmation. Moderate Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill will vote against Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court, narrowing the number of potential Democratic votes the nominee can secure. The Missouri senator, who is up for re-election this fall, is in a conservative state, cited Kavanaugh's views on dark anonymous money that is crushing our democracy. She said that the troubling allegation of sexual assault leveled against Kavanaugh did not influence her decision. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. This past weekend, September 15th and 16th, marked the 10th anniversary of the Lehman Brothers investment bank collapse and the subsequent generalized financial system crash that followed. Can this happen again? To answer this question and others, let's turn to my first guest. He's the author of the recently published book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression, and he joins us via Skype to discuss his article on the 10th anniversary of Lehman Brothers 2008, Can It Happen Again? Dr. Jack Rasmus. Dr. Rasmus, welcome to the Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
The first part of your article is about the failure of Lehman Brothers and whether or not the then U.S. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and the chair of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, should have allowed that to happen. Why is the crash of Lehman Brothers the focal point of your piece?
Well, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, it accelerated the financial crisis throughout the entire credit system in the U.S. and globally. So it's kind of like a milestone in the financial crisis that had been brewing at least a year before. And that's why it's important. It also reflects the shift from subprime mortgages as the major driver of the financial downturn to the collapse of the derivatives markets, particularly credit default swaps, CDOs, and other derivatives that then spread the contagion very rapidly throughout the entire banking credit system and brought down the entire system. So Lehman Brothers is kind of like a fulcrum that accelerated the whole crisis. And the question is, why did Lehman collapse? And to really understand that, you got to look at the relationship, not just with Lehman Brothers, but with two other major large financial institutions in September 2008. And those other institutions were the big Goldman Sachs investment bank, a competitor to Lehman Brothers, and the giant AIG insurance company. Understanding what happened in the early weeks of September between those three companies and the role played by then Secretary of Treasury Henry Paulson, who 2 years previous was the CEO of Goldman Sachs. That's the smoking gun of why Lehman Brothers was allowed to go under that then accelerated the crisis.
You write, on the fiscal policy side of the bailout, the Obama administration provided a mere $25 billion to help bail out the 14 million homeowners that would eventually face foreclosures during the crash and recovery, quote-unquote recovery period. In contrast, however, it provided $1 trillion in business investor tax cuts in 2009 and 10, $200 billion in the 2009 recovery program, supplemented by another $800 billion at the close of 2010. I've said for years that if the toxic subprime mortgages were at the core of the problem, and that's what we've been told ad nauseum, then President Obama should have protected the homeowner by backing the toxic mortgages instead of allowing so many people to lose their homes and the wealth that went with it. Is that too simplistic of an analysis?
No, there's a lot of truth to that. Even when he was running for office in the election year 2008, Obama was very clear in his advisors that they didn't consider the solution to the housing crisis, which was well on its way at that time, actually bailing out the homeowners. What they thought was the solution was to get those people who couldn't afford the homes out of the homes and get those mortgages refiled. So they assisted the banks and the mortgage companies to actually, boosted their balance sheet and provided incentives so that those people would get out of the homes. And in fact, this whole question of credit default swaps played a role in housing at the time. There were actually banks who wanted foreclosures and failures because these banks had written bets, credit default swaps, derivatives, that the homeowners would foreclose. And they would make more money by foreclosing people than they would by keeping people in their homes.
But we were told, and again, if this is too simplistic or if I'm wrong, please straighten me out, We were told that the toxic mortgages from the subprime were the cause. And I'm looking at, well, then if you make those bad mortgages good, you keep people in their homes, the values in the neighborhoods remain stable. We know, for example, that, you know, budgets for public schools, many of them come out of property taxes. So you keep the neighborhood stable, you keep the school system stable. People don't zero out on the equity that they've built up in their. I mean, to me, there were so many things that made sense to keep the homeowner there. Putting people out of their homes just to me made absolutely no sense.
Well, actually, during the 1930s, there was a similar housing crisis, and the solution under FDR was to keep people in their homes. We created homeowners corporations, which actually the government bought, in many cases, bought their mortgages and reissued their mortgages for a longer term, thus reducing the amount people had to pay so that they could stay in their homes. That was the origin of the 30-year mortgage in the 1930s, you know. So that's what they did in the 30s. They could have done this time, but they didn't.
Let me jump in real quick, because I remember President Obama's, I remember this like it was yesterday. People were asking him, why did you bail out the banks and then not require the banks to lend the money back to the communities? And he looked in the camera and said, we didn't think that's what the banks would do. And I said to myself, dude, if you give them money and don't force them to invest it in the community, banks are going to do what banks do, sit on the money.
Well, that's actually what they did. But you got to understand, it wasn't the Congress that bailed out the banks.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Federal Reserve
right.
that bailed out the banks in 2009 at a cost of about $6 trillion. $6
trillion. Mm-hmm.
At the time in September, October, Congress passed the Troubled Asset Release Program, TARP, right?
Yes.
$750 billion was given to Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, to spend. He only spent half of that, put the rest back into Treasury, and what he spent it on was to bail out AIG and the auto companies and a few small medium-sized banks. He did not bail out the big banks with that TARP money. What actually bailed out the banks was the Federal Reserve, the central bank, providing them up to $6 trillion of free loans, zero interest loans virtually, and the government, the Federal Reserve, buying up all their bad mortgages at above market prices, and then conducting phony stress tests to get investors to buy bank stock again. This was all in the spring of 2009. And then the Federal Reserve kept interest rates at 0.1% for the next 6-7 years,
mm-hmm.
bailed out these banks, subsidized the banking system is really what it did. So the Federal Reserve, $6 trillion, bailed out the banks, not Obama or the government. What Obama did was to pass some housing programs that gave incentives to banks like Bank of America and so forth, the bank servicing companies, to provide lower interest rates to keep people in their homes. Well, you know, if you can't afford to pay your home, it doesn't do much good if you lower your interest rate from 6% to 3%. And it was really the money that he spent, the HARP program and so forth, that Obama spent, was really subsidies to the banks themselves to not proceed as fast in the foreclosures.
This week marks, in your piece, the 10th anniversary of the 2008 crash. Most say it could never happen again. Banks are better regulated. They have significant capital buffers to offset losses should another collapse of their asset prices occur. You write, we have the Volcker Rule. The subprime mortgage housing problem is no longer. Housing finance reforms are in place and so forth, but don't bet on it. Why?
Okay, to answer that question, you got to understand why Lehman fell, right? And the role of the government in assisting the collapse of Lehman Brothers and before that, Bear Stearns and other banks. The main theme of my article is that the government played a big role in the collapse of Lehman Brothers because it was willing to allow these smaller, medium-sized investment banks like Bear and Lehman to collapse in order to shore up the balance sheets of the larger banks like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. What happened in September of 2008 with Lehman Brothers was that Hank Paulson, Treasury Secretary, former CEO of Goldman Sachs just 2 years previously, decided after bailing out a number of financial institutions before Lehman, decided to let Lehman go bust. Now, why did he decide that? Because what happened was Goldman Sachs had bought a lot of credit default swaps from AIG. AIG had issued all these CDSs that Lehman would fail. And Goldman bought tens of billions of these CDSs from AIG that Lehman would fail. So if Lehman was allowed to fail by Paulson, Goldman Sachs would collect huge amounts, billions, from AIG on its credit default swap bets. Now, that meant that AIG would collapse, and Paulson turned around and bailed out AIG within a week. He let Lehman collapse, and then he bailed out AIG, and the government gave $100 billion to AIG, and a lot of that was paid to Goldman Sachs for its bet on the CDS. Now, that's a smoking gun, as far as I'm concerned, and you know, it's an indictment of Henry Paulson. Why did he let Lehman collapse so Goldman could get rich on derivatives issued by AIG and then bail out AIG? Now, the same thing happened 6 months previously between the Federal Reserve and the collapse of another investment bank called Bear Stearns. The Federal Reserve partnered with J.P. Morgan Chase. Chase precipitated the collapse of Bear Stearns. Chase had been a longtime lender to Bear Stearns, but decided in February not to lend Bear any more money, and that led to its collapse. Well, then, you know, Bernanke partners with J.P. Morgan Chase, gives a $29 billion loan to Chase, who didn't need it, to buy Bear Stearns pennies on the dollar. So Chase scoops up Bear Stearns for pennies on the dollar, and all of its customers and everything, you know, a big windfall for for J.P. Chase. And Goldman Sachs makes tens of billions of dollars on the derivatives, allowing Lehman to collapse. So the Fed and the Treasury played a central role in precipitating the crash of some of these banks on behalf of the bigger banks. You see, the bigger banks made money off of these collapses. But that then accelerated the general financial crisis. So the government played a central role in all this, is the theme of my article,
and
which can be read at jackrasmus.com. But, you know, the media and, you know, the mainstream press does not talk about that when they talk about Lehman Brothers and so forth. Although there is a book that just came out by Lawrence Ball, an academic who talks about Lehman the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve could have bailed out Lehman, as well as the Treasury could have bailed out Lehman. The Federal Reserve, Bernanke, bailed out Lehman's competitor, Bear Stearns, 6 months earlier, and then refused to bail out Lehman in September. Well, you know, did Henry Paulson ask Bernanke not to bail out Lehman? We'll never know. And if he did, what were his motives?
And so as we look at the banking structure today,
the banking structure today, the next crisis, which is coming sooner than people think, I believe.
Okay.
I've done a major study on this called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy in 2016, before my Central Bankers book. It's coming, and it will be at the center will be the derivatives problem once again. This is what spreads the contagion across banks and financial institutions rapidly and deeply. It's the derivatives phenomenon out there that is really, there's so much money by investors, they're just betting on all this stuff now. What are the derivatives of the future? It won't occur in the mortgage market. It won't occur with subprime mortgages. I believe the central role will be played by exchange-traded funds and passive index investing, and it will come from the stock market
rather
than from the property markets.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression is the book and the article on the 10th anniversary of Lehman Brothers 2008, Can It Happen Again? Dr. Jack Rasmus, sir, thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on the Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Today, the United States imposed sanctions on a Chinese military agency and its director for buying defense equipment from Russia in breach of a sweeping U.S. sanctions bill enacted in 2017. Why was this done, and what does it mean going forward? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a senior fellow at the Independent Institute and director of the Independent Institute's Center on Peace and Liberty, Dr. Ivan Elin. Dr. Elin, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us. So help us here. Why has the Trump administration decided to take what I understand is an incredibly unprecedented action against this Chinese military agency?
Well, I think it's the sanctions are mainly directed towards Russia for the election hacking and other things, but I think that they do sanction this one Chinese arms procuring agency, I think because they buy Russian weaponry. And so even though the Chinese agency is listed, I think that the major effect of the sanctions have been against Russia.
But isn't this, I don't know if this is illegal, but it just doesn't seem to make any sense. I can understand the sanctions as it relates to what is becoming this trade war with China, but when has legally buying military equipment from Russia become a focal point of U.S. sanction policy? I mean, Turkey has bought the S-400 system. India, one of the world's largest arms importers, has been buying arms from Russia for years. So I don't understand. Help me out here.
Well, the U.S. sometimes puts extraterritorial sanctions on countries. For instance, against Iran, the U.S. has threatened that any banks doing business with Iran will not be able to do banking business in the U.S. And of course, the U.S. has a much bigger market than Iran. So many European banks, because the U.S. has put the sanctions back on Iran, many of those European banks are skittish about doing financial transactions with Iran. So it's sort of an indirect way. Now, I don't think in this case, against the Chinese, I don't think it's going to have much effect. It prevents export licenses, but the U.S. really doesn't send any exports of U.S. arms to China anyway. And so that's probably, and then there's some, the head of the Chinese arms agency, I believe they've sanctioned him and he can't do any financial transactions in the U.S. or whatever. Now that, I don't know what his status, what his finances are, where he does his financing or whatever, but it could possibly affect him. But I think that the effect of the U.S. sanctions on China will probably be minimal. They're probably more symbolic than anything else.
Do you see this as another stick that the Trump administration is trying to use, another bludgeon maybe that the United States is trying to use against President Xi Jinping and trying to get China to the table and trying to get them to acquiesce to the trade sanctions?
Well, that may be a factor in it, but I think it's probably mainly this is directed toward Russia because this is really not going to hurt China all that much. Now, the tariffs that the trade war that you're speaking of, some of those will hurt China, because it's quite a lot of trade. It's about, if you know, the $200 billion is included, you've probably got about half of U.S. trade with China has been slapped with tariffs by Trump now. So that is a significant development. But I think this is probably not really going to hurt China that much. There may be some of this. Yeah, well, let's get China too, because you know they're not playing ball on trade. But I think most of the trade war is with China directly rather than through this arms sanctions.
So is this then a message to other countries in the world who are thinking about buying the S-400 anti-missile defense system, trying to get people to buy the Patriot?
Yeah, well, it could be, yes, and it could be a message to countries like Turkey, who are NATO allies, not to buy Russian equipment, and other maybe neutral countries or whatever that may buy Russian equipment. So, they could have, if they buy Russian equipment, they may not be able to buy U.S. equipment. It could be a symbolic thing against China, but it may not be so symbolic against other countries that buy U.S. weaponry. And a lot of countries in the world do, since the U.S. is the leading arms exporter in the world.
It's interesting to me, this type of action would have made sense to me, in my mind, back in the 40s and 50s when we did not have the integration that we have now, the international integration of weapon systems. For example, Turkey, they bought the S-400 missile system, but they are providing parts to the United States for the F-35. There are, I think, 10 Turkish companies that work with Lockheed Martin and Pratt Whitney. In fact, one, ASAS, is the sole supplier of two major F-35 components, the missile remote interface unit and the panoramic cockpit display. So this to me really seems to be, I don't want to say futile, but it just seems to be almost senseless because of the integrated nature of trade and particularly of weapons development and weapon systems. Does that make sense?
Weapons, there are some arrangements like that, but weapon systems tend to be less globalized than other things because countries like to produce their own. But of course, the U.S. does sell to these places, and it does include a limited number of parts from other countries, usually allies, because the U.S. doesn't want to depend on even neutral countries for its own weapon systems. And of course, the U.S. is selling its own weapon systems around the world so that it can get economies of scale, so its own weapons are cheaper. But it's not going to go hog wild letting subcontractors in other countries participate. Now, Turkey is a shaky ally anyway nowadays, and so they may have regretted signing up for that. But if it's Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Italian companies, et cetera, other NATO countries, or at least reliable NATO countries, there may be more of it. But it usually the British are the only ones that we really do a lot with subcontracting on a big scale that are trusted to do that. Because like I say, all these parts are put into U.S. weapons and then they're re-exported around the world. But first of all, they're U.S. weapons. So weaponry tends to be less globalized because of the nature of people wanting their own systems. Particularly the U.S. military is very, very nervous about having parts from countries that are unreliable. And I would put Turkey in that category now, as far as U.S. has had a lot of tensions with Turkey over Gulen and the coup and people that are held hostage, U.S. citizens held hostage in Turkey. So this may be a relic of a bygone days. These contracts go over multiple years, and I'm not an expert in the Turkish subcontracting market, but this may have been, these contracts may have been from another time.
So did you find this action today taken by the Trump administration to be a surprise? And Have you been able to formulate any ideas in terms of what you see with this going forward?
Well, I think that until the relationship between U.S.-Russia improves, and like I say, this is a move that's primarily aimed at tightening the sanctions on Russia. China is just either included to be a symbol to other countries not to buy Russian
weapon systems.
Most probably, because I can't really see it that it's going to have a major effect on China itself. So I think you can see continuing tightening of sanctions, because I think basically the bureaucracy, the security bureaucracies and agencies, and even the White House National Security Advisor are much, and the Congress, of course, are all much more hardline on Russia than Trump is. And I think he's having to cave in a little bit because of the Russia scandal here. So I think you could probably see that sanctions will keep tightening on Russia.
I'm glad you mentioned the tensions between Trump and others in the White House and in the administration, I mean, in the Defense Department, because some are arguing that this is really a battle amongst the elites within this country. And those who are looking at this from the larger global economic scale and their finances and world economy versus those who are looking at this from a more militaristic perspective, such as the Bolton and Pompeo, who haven't seen a war they didn't like.
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as a war amongst elites. I would characterize it a war against the U.S. establishment versus Trump, because he's the only one at this stage, I think, that really wants to have a better relationship with Russia. I think the Congress, his national security team like Bolton and Pompeo, have always been hardliners, and they have to placate him to some extent. But there's really, in many foreign policies, not just with Russia, but other foreign policies, there's sort of a two-track policy. There's what the president says, and then there's what the bureaucracy in Congress want. And
a la North Korea.
I think that's the same, exactly. I think Trump has a softer line against North Korea than the bureaucracy does.
And, well,
sort of, it's the same, I would say it's in the same, well, let's say not exactly the same, but parallel policies. Trump is softer, and the security establishment and the Congress are harder line in both cases.
Well, and it would seem in both cases, in terms of Trump's policy towards Russia and Trump's policy towards North Korea, if you start to make friends and you tamp down the perception of military threat, then it becomes harder to make the case to sell military systems. And for example, if Trump is able, Kim Jong-un wants an end to the Korean War. If the United States gets positioned to sign a treaty ending the Korean War, then the next question is, well, then why do we need all these troops in South Korea?
Right. And I think that's Kim's strategy, is he's trying to take it down. And so, you know, that will be the thing. If he can get them to agree that the war has ended, then, of course, everybody's then he has an excuse for saying, well, gee, why are these American troops there? So I think that's Kim's goal at this point. And I'm not sure the South Korean leader really wants to make peace, but the problem will become, does South Korea trust North Korea, you know, to actively carry through with denuclearization and that sort of thing? Because if North Korea would do that, of course, then the South Koreans would probably say to the United States, well, you know, we're a sovereign nation and we no longer need your troops here. So, and, you know, that's a possibility. I think it's pretty low probability, but it is a possibility that could be the outcome. It may not be a bad outcome if they could get denuclearization of North Korea and U.S. forces to withdraw there, because I think Jimmy Carter tried to withdraw U.S. forces from South Korea in the 70s, and that was rebuffed by the security bureaucracy. He didn't get it done. So, you know, this is long overdue.
And lurking in the minds of those anti-North Korean individuals is, well, North Korea has always had the plan to unify the country, take over South Korea, and take over Japan.
Right. Well, that's been the threat. I mean,
right.
Japan is in close proximity, and Japan is really the crown jewel, or was when the South Korean alliance was set up with the U.S. Now, of course, South Korea is also an economic jewel because it's been, the economic miracle there versus the North. And so, therefore, the United States is now also interested in keeping South Korea in, in the U.S. orbit, and certainly free from any invasion or anything like that. But of course, the Korean War was fought in 1950, and now South Korea has like 30 times the GDP of the North. So South Korea could really defend itself without U.S. troops there. Of course, you couldn't pull them out right away. You'd have to say over a 5-year period or whatever, eventually we're going to pull out, and then you're going to have to defend yourself.
But you take the economic development of South Korea, you take the resources of the North, and when those two come together, you now have an economic power, a burgeoning economic power that would rival a lot of other countries.
Yeah, well, it could. I mean, if they freed up the North, they'd have to free up the North Korean economy. It would have to be the South taking over the North rather than the North taking over the South, because if that the latter happened, you just have a communist country that didn't work.
But they can't find a working relationship. Instead of one taking over the other, they can't mutually, peacefully coexist for the economic benefit of both?
Yeah, they could. They could. But I think you still run into the problem where the two systems are different. I mean, it's possible they could work things out, and it may happen that way. But certainly, if North Korea starts freeing itself up, like the Soviet Union did, you may see that it just collapses and, something replaces it. It doesn't really have to go with unification. I think if the two systems were more similar or even more similar, then, there'd be a greater chance of unification. But if the systems stay the same way, the South isn't going to want to go towards the North, and the North is not going to want to go towards the South as far as changing their system. So, it's possible they could coexist and there could be a settlement, but I don't think the U.S. Security establishment is willing to withdraw the forces. Now, Trump might be able to force them to do that because he seems to be oriented that way, although the military has swayed him on other.
Exactly.
We'll have to see what happens. But, I mean, he could reach some sort of an agreement.
I got Dr. Elin, I got to stop you there. I got a hard stop. And I look forward to bringing you back, Dr. Ivan Elin, Senior Fellow at the Independent Institute and Director of the Independent Institute Center on Peace and Liberty. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming on the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. As we continue to navigate the turbulent waters of the Trumpian era, there are two stories that struck me today. First, problems continue to grow for Ron DeSantis in Florida. A Republican activist who donated more than $20,000 to Ron DeSantis' gubernatorial campaign called President Obama a effing Muslim N-word on Twitter recently, in addition to other inflammatory remarks. The second story, Black patients and Native Americans are missing out on promising cancer drugs. A ProPublica analysis found that African Americans and Native Americans are underrepresented in clinical trials of new drugs, even when the treatment is aimed at a type of cancer that disproportionately affects them. These two stories are just today's examples of the systemic nature of racism, white supremacy, as Dr. Welsing would say, in America. A number of analysts want to deal with Trump as though he's an anomaly or exists in some type of vacuum. I believe that he is and demonstrates what America is and has always been. To get further insight into this, let's turn to my next guest. She's an associate professor of sociology and Africana studies at Stony Brook University and joins us to discuss her book, How to Be Less Stupid About Race, on racism, white supremacy, and the racial divide. Dr. Crystal Fleming, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Dr. Fleming, help me out. I was watching a news show a while back, and someone asked, how has America come to this point, talking about Trump? And I started screaming at the television, this is where America has always been. Your thoughts?
Oh, I mean, I think on this point, we're definitely in agreement. I have a whole chapter of the book that just came out. It's called Trump Country. And it explains that, yeah, this idea that Trump is some kind of alien force that's taken over U.S. politics and that this is a radically different political moment than it was under Obama or prior administrations, I think is just a really fundamental misreading of our situation. And it shows not just how ignorant people are about our politics now, but how historically ignorant so many folks are about where we've come from and what, in your words, we've always been. And to be clear, my critique of white supremacy in the United States, which I definitely underscore is foundational to our politics, right? But my critique is not just about white supremacy in the United States. It's about global white supremacy. So, you know, to a large extent, enriching folks who are socially defined as white, this is a Western project. And the United States has been on the forefront of it. But it's, you know, scientific racism and a lot of the ideology and certainly the practice, if we go before scientific racism, we go to the practice of transatlantic slavery and racial capitalism. These are European projects. So what I try to lay out in the book is a critique of white supremacy in our society, the historical foundations, but also a global awareness of it, right? And in part, this is because my own research, my first book, was about white supremacy and the legacies of slavery and colonialism in France, so in Europe. So, yeah, this is not some, you know, radically new move moment, this Trump era, even though, let's be clear, Trump is, you know, in many ways an unconventional politician. But we are seeing the continuation of white supremacy, and a lot of folks don't want to admit it was still a white supremacist country under Obama.
You argue that many core features of his agenda, overt racism, xenophobia, sexism, evisceration of the safety net and fascist tendencies, that these are longstanding features of this country's political project.
Absolutely. You know, just take one of the examples I unpack in the book. You know, it's been a lot said about the fact that Trump is endorsed by neo-Nazis globally. And, you know, basically has surrounded himself with white nationalists. But what there's not an acknowledgement of is that, you know, we have had prior administrations not just normalize Nazis, but actually, you know, in the aftermath of World War II, our country invited Nazi scientists to the United States and recruited them, helped whitewash their war crimes and their involvement in the Holocaust, and incorporate them into our country, right? So that's just one example, but we could go beyond that. The establishment of white supremacy in the United States inspired Nazis as they developed their ideologies and practices to try to wipe out their Jewish population. So the idea is still, even today in 2018, Nazis are often held up as like the worst embodiment of white supremacy. But in fact, they were inspired by white supremacists here in the United States. So, Yeah, I mean, I think the historical record is pretty clear on this point.
There are those who want to draw distinctions between President Trump and President Obama, and there are distinctions that can be drawn, no question. But I think it's important to understand that as a president of the United States, they are, as Amiri Baraka said to me a number of times, they are both functionaries of and have an allegiance to the state. And you draw connections between the Democratic-flavored neoliberalism and white supremacy we saw under the Obama administration and the politics of the present regime. How so? Particularly, if you could lay a good foundation explaining the Democratic-flavored neoliberalism under Obama, because that goes by a whole lot of folks.
You know, I still think a lot of people are not ready to admit that, you know, Obama, you know, was the black face of a white supremacist empire. But that's reality, right? I mean, we could take something as simple as the Confederacy, right? So we've seen under Trump's presidency, there's a lot more public contestation over Confederate memorials and so on, and, you know, everything from Bree Newsom, you know, climbing and taking down, you know, the Confederate flag. And, you know, we're just seeing a wave of challenging the memorials to white supremacists and the Confederacy. But what folks don't talk about enough, and I mentioned in the book, How to Be Less Stupid About Race, and the chapter on Obama, Obama honored the Confederacy every year of his presidency, like presidents before him. So, I mean, I don't know how can we make it clearer than that? I mean, we could take it also to, you know, the kind of post-racial rhetoric that he bought into, sometimes implicitly, sometimes explicitly. But Obama made it really clear, particularly in how he treated his pastor, if we want to take it back to Reverend Wright.
We can go there.
Jeremiah Wright. But he made it very clear that he was going to distance himself from Jeremiah Wright, condemning white supremacy in the United States, and make it clear that from Obama's perspective, we don't live in a white supremacist society. You know, he made it clear that he did not think that racism, at least he was not going to say, that racism is endemic to the United States.
And right? Dr. Fleming,
and
I need you to do me a favor. I need you to take off your house slippers, and I need you to put on your marching shoes and come march with me. That's what I need you to do.
Later on today
when you're done teaching.
Yeah, when I'm done. I'm about to go teach another class. But yes, when I'm done teaching, yes.
You know, but just quickly, because we only have just a couple minutes left. So that's on the domestic side. But if you put it, if you look at foreign policy and you ask yourself, what happened to Muammar Gaddafi? Why is he assassinated? Yeah. If you look at who greenlit the war in Yemen, if you look at what's going on in Syria, the attacks of using drones. I mean, there are so many things that were greenlit. Under President Obama, he was more hawkish and more Bush than George Bush.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about something like under Obama's presidency, like eight at least, you know, foreign wars, right? Someone who was given the Nobel Peace Prize. And I think particularly Obama's African-American supporters, and you get to, you asked about Democratic, you know, flavors of neoliberalism and all of this. But I think so much of it is also tied up in great apathy, either apathy for or defense of, you know, these imperialist wars that fall, you know, the great weight of them falling on the backs of black and brown people abroad. Mm-hmm. And I've been appalled by the apathy and, you know, just the, you know, broad American population about all this, but also among African-American supporters of Obama. Just, you know, what impact have our policies had on black and brown people around the world? And there's always been a connection between white supremacy and its practice in this country and the role of the United States in being an imperial Western power. So I would just say, and it's a lot of what I try to talk about in the book, right, that it's so important to draw connections between the continuities in these practices across administrations and, you know, continuities between the racism that we encounter and we see every day here at home and the, you know, the global scale that you know, connection between white supremacy and foreign policy, for sure.
We just have about 2 minutes left. So what are the two or three things that you want the reader to walk away understanding after they have finished your book?
Gosh, well, you know, some of it is very basic, but, you know, we still live in a society where there's just so much denial about the existence of racism. And the example of, you know, the politician calling, you know, Obama the N-word and saying it's not racist. I think I tweeted something like this, you know, just as satire, you know, recently, like, you know, white supremacists are going to start saying that using the N-word is not racist. But, you know, these are the kinds of absurd logics that we have lived with for generations, just the complete absurd denial of racism, no matter how violent, no matter what form. You know, it is in the interest of those who benefit from white supremacy to say it doesn't exist. So, you know, the need to combat racial denial, but also the need to be very clear about what systemic racism is and what it means, and understanding that it isn't, you know, how I feel about someone. It's not, you know, merely personal prejudice. But we're talking about, you know, a system of power in which, you know, folks who are socially defined as white are systematically given not just, you know, privilege and social honor, but resources and economic dominance. That's how we get the racial wealth gap and how it's maintained from one generation to the next. And not even maintained, actually, that it keeps growing. When Obama was president in Washington, D.C., white households held 81 times the wealth of black families in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. And, you know, that gap keeps growing, and it's by design. And the third thing I just throw out, I mean, of course, there's a lot more right. that I talk about in the book, but the last thing would be the need to listen to and center the perspectives of black women, specifically in the conversation around race and racism. Black women get silenced and marginalized throughout our society, but it's especially egregious in conversations about race and racism. I mean, you'll see entire panels, you know, where right. people are discussing these issues and there's no black woman involved, or, you know, there's no effort to draw on the critical insights of black feminist thought and intersectionality and all that. And even, you know, the work of black women outside of the academy, the activists, the organizers, the everyday black women who have, you know, deep and profound knowledge, not just about how racism and white supremacy work, but also how these things are tightly woven and connected with sexism and patriarchy and misogyny.
Let me stop you. So let me stop you there.
Let me stop you there
so you can get to class. So you can get to class on time. Thank you. Dr. Crystal Fleming, How to Be Less Stupid About Race on Racism, White Supremacy, and the Racial Divide. Again, thank you so much for coming on the Critical Hour and look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. It's another day. It's another Critical Hour. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.